Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, Robert Knott is not going to be with us speaking of the arts. He is taking a much-needed day off, and we are going to hear from the poet Anne Valley Fox. Right now, I'm delighted to welcome Gabe Gomez. He is with SWIA, the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts, and Liz Wallace, who is a silversmith. She's Maidu, Washoe, and Navajo. We'll be talking about all those different traditions and the work that she does. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for having us. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
So, Gabe, SWIA is the organization that puts on Indian Market every year. And you do things at other times of year, too. Specifically, this weekend is a huge weekend for Indian arts events.
Correct. It's, as you were saying, we do several things, most notably the Indian Market that happens the third weekend of August every year. But the Winter Showcase, this is the fourth year, and it's gone through a reinvention of sorts, as much of the Indian Market did as well, with some of the programs. And so in addition to the, I think the number now is, 190 artists that have also participated, that participated at least in this year's market in August. So we'll have those artists over a three-day weekend, beginning today on the 27th and going through Sunday. Plus we have the Winter Cinema Showcase, which is an extension of our Native Cinema Showcase that we had in the summer in our collaboration with the Smithsonian and CCA. And we also have artist demonstrations and, you know, kids activities and all sorts of other fun things happening. So we really loaded it up, and again, we had
that's crazy.
It's insane in that we had the idea of how can we make this family friendly. We have a lot of people coming in town, and really make it for somebody, you know, who, you know, people are looking for something to do. Well, you want to watch a film, you want to, you know, look at some really beautiful artwork, and, you know, so we tried to approach it from all kinds of angles this year and really make it a community event.
It is true that a lot of people are in from out of town, so people who didn't come for Indian Market, let's say, in the summer, can have a kind of a second chance at it.
Exactly, and it's again, the artists that participated in Market, that was kind of one of the guidelines. If you wanted to be a part of Winter Showcase, you have to be already, you know, in Summer Market.
So you don't have to go through a whole new process of application.
Well, there is an application, but it's not quite as strenuous. You know, we have obviously the images that are submitted, so there is a separate application, but that's just one of the guidelines again to be a part of that. So, but yeah, like I said, it's we really pulled together. We reached out to the community and asked, you know, various restaurants and organizations and say, you want to partner in offering some special deals, and it worked out beautifully, and it's going to be a really great event. We're excited.
Where is it happening? Where is the actual market part of it happening?
Santa Fe Convention Center. All of the activities are happening at the Convention Center. The Sweeney Room is where we'll have all of our artists selling their artwork. In the rooms that are next to the main room, the O'Keefe and the Kearney and some other rooms, we'll have, again, our artist demonstrations. We'll also have our kids' activities and the films, so it's all going to be in-house. So one ticket, you know, we'll get you all those things. So
very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, Liz, you are a jeweler. You're a silversmith. Did you learn, for example, specific Native traditions of silversmithing when you were learning your craft?
Well, actually, my father was a jewelry maker for as long as I can remember, and he has participated in Indian Market for many years. He doesn't anymore, but I remember being very small, about 5 years old, and coming to Santa Fe and being crashed out on the sidewalk, you know, with very early in the Saturday morning of Indian Market, and watching all the customers, their feet milling around, and and going to Geppetto's, which isn't here anymore, and getting the shaved ice, and going to the gift shop in La Fonda. So I grew up with jewelry. But I didn't actually take up silver working until I was about 20 years old. And I was actually living here in Santa Fe and took a class at the Santa Fe Community College. And from there, it started just selling straight away. So I stuck with it. And 13 years later, here I am.
You do some very beautiful work that people can find on the internet, and you can give your websites if you would like. I was looking at some that were in the shape of starfish and other very beautiful organic forms. You work from nature, at least partly.
Oh, yes. Ever since I was very small, I loved to play with bugs. I used to catch grasshoppers and play with caterpillars. And my parents and my grandmother used to go to the beach. I grew up in Northern California. So we would go to San Francisco, and my grandmother liked to take me to the Japanese gardens at the Presidio. And just being exposed to that particular aesthetic, the Japanese aesthetic, was really inspiring. And then going to the beach and collecting sand dollars. And I think I picked up every broken sand dollar and broken sea urchin on the beach. And I still have some of those things, lots of shells, like mussel shells. And I actually wanted to be a marine biologist when I was a little girl. So this last year especially, I started incorporating this nostalgic sense, all these images and memories from my childhood and things that really inspired me when I was a child, and putting them into my work. And up until then, I'd been doing a lot of the very traditional turquoise and silver type of jewelry, what you would sort of expect in the Southwest.
It's so interesting how, when a person is doing an art and a craft of the kind that you are, that you learn the traditions, and then as you become really skilled in your craft, those memories and those things bubble up within you, and you can take the craft much further.
Yes, it's amazing. I really didn't expect that. I remember I love looking at books of jewelry, and I would see sometimes a jeweled starfish. There's one starfish brooch that Salvador Dali designed and had made, and it was one of the things I kept going to when I was looking through my books. And I started thinking, hey, why can't I do that, you know? And so I started taking more classes at the community college, which has a wonderful jewelry studio and program, and then my work just took on this whole new direction that was very unexpected for me, and it's been very enjoyable.
Are you using different kinds of stone than the straight turquoise?
Yes, I've been getting into labradorite and fossil sand dollars and some more coral.
Fossil sand dollars?
Yes, fossilized sand dollars.
Wow. Do they look like regular sand dollars that you find on the beach?
Yes, they're really wonderful. They're about an inch across, and I find them at Natural Stones over on Baca Street. He's the only person that has them, and I've bought a lot of them, and they're so much fun. I've made earrings and pins, and I've added long tentacles with spikes, and they're really fun.
Now, during Indian Market, what's it called, Gabe? Is it called Indian Market Winter?
It's Winter Showcase.
Winter Showcase.
Yeah.
Thank you. Getting our term straight here. You will be doing, you'll not only be showing your work, but are you also going to be doing any of those demonstrations and so on?
I'll be in the booth, mostly.
Gabe, tell us about these demonstrations, because there's
some
really great things going on.
What we decided to do this year was really try to capture all of the kinds of art forms that are represented within the market, essentially. So we will have this year's Best of Show winners, Daryl and Rebecca Begay. They will be doing some tufa casting. Liz could tell you.
Well, in the Southwest, there is a sedimentary layer that's exposed in some places. It's compacted volcanic ash from a volcanic eruption thousands and thousands of years ago. And it's white, it's pretty lightweight, and it's very carvable. And so the native peoples for many years, probably close to 100 years, have been going out into these places and carving out a hunk of this stuff. And you can cut it, you can carve it, and then put two halves together and pour molten silver into that mold. And open it up, and you come up with whatever shape you carved in. And Daryl and Rebecca Begay are absolute masters at this technique. They can get so much detail. I can get pretty simple shapes, and I use... I I tief a cast on occasion, but Daryl and Rebecca are absolutely incredible at it.
It's an incredible piece. The I believe it's called The Long Journey Home. It essentially looks like a concha belt, but different scenes of depictions, and the tail work on that is just exquisite. I mean, just really, it is masterful. And they'll be doing they have both a video of the longer process of that carving and they'll have some hands-on stuff as well. So,
when you pour molten silver into that kind of a mold, does it come out with kind of the quality of the stone in some way?
Yeah, it depends on the tufa rock itself. Many times it has a texture. Sometimes it's very dense, and some of the tufa I have is so dense that it leaves a pretty smooth texture. So some of the molds or some of the castings I've gotten from these molds actually it's difficult to tell it was tufa.
So it looks like a very smooth, shiny silver.
Yes, but with many tufa carvers, the texture is very desirable, and the Begays are very good. They get all this detail, and many times you only get one try at the casting because all the detail causes the metal to stick in the little nooks and crannies, and so when you pull the metal out, it'll take part of the rock with it. So you have to be very... very good and get it right the first time, hopefully.
Now, there's also beading.
Absolutely. Terry Greaves, also a Best of Show winner for the Santa Fe Indie Market, former Best of Show winner. Terry has very generously agreed to do two things. She will be doing art demonstrations of her own beadwork and quill work, and she's also doing kids' workshops for the 3 days, for Friday, today, tomorrow, and Sunday. And those workshops, again, they're hands-on, and it has to do with family lineage and the sort of the origins of people's names and things like that. It's specifically designed, the workshop is specifically designed for kids. So it's just going to be fabulous.
Now, when kids do beading, sometimes, I mean, having done quite a bit of beading myself, it's really labor-intensive and requires a lot of patience, which is maybe
which is why Terry's doing it.
Well, she's, and also maybe it's a vehicle to teach kids that level of patience.
Absolutely. No, it is a time-consuming, as you know, effort. And judging by the work that Terry produces is just it's amazing.
What are some of her pieces look like?
Some of her pieces, actually, she's probably best known for her work. She beads Chuck's Converse tennis shoes.
Right.
She does. I mean, literally, the British Museum is, you know, they collect her stuff. And
I like the high-heeled ones.
The high-heeled
Converse.
The high-heeled. And you can find them on her website and stuff. But it's just absolutely extraordinary. She was actually just featured in I forget the name of the series, but it's a PBS series of artists or craft in America, something like that. And I know the Museum of New Mexico premiered it, and Terry was the featured artist in that. That's probably what she's known for. She also does belts and all sorts of other things. But quite extraordinary.
In terms of Indian Market, probably some of our listeners were there in August, and probably some of them just could not bear to try to drive their car downtown. They decided to go the other way as quickly as possible. So what are some of the traditional kinds of forms that you see, and what are some of the more unusual and unexpected forms?
Well, I think some of the, I guess, that's a huge question to begin with, but I think it's, you're going to find both, I think, traditional and quote-unquote innovation or innovative forms in all of these types of genres. So if you look, so for our potters and our jewelers, I mean, again, you're going to have, very traditional styles of jewelry, the kind of things that you would associate with native style jewelry. And then, of course, you'll have Liz and, you know, other artists like Maria Zamora and Pat Pruitt. Who I wear this very, very proudly. Never mind.
This a very nice
bracelet that he's wearing
that's
right
what I'm
now,
saying.
Ladies and gentlemen. Go ahead and hold it up to the microphone so our listeners at home can see.
Look at this bad thing. But anyhow, and that's the real joy. I mean, at least for me, for working this organization, it's just discovering, just learning something new about the kinds of art forms, produced and created by native peoples. It's extraordinary, and it's endless, and it's And the real, once you become involved with it, it's discovering the nuance of it. And the little things like the 2-foot casting, for instance, that you just mentioned, that's just, it's just, again, it's so complex, it's so beautiful, and it's really the differences between, you know, one artist to the next is just, the differences could be huge. So I think there's a real joy and a real, it's a real gift to be able to interact with the artists and really see their work up close and have them talk to you about it, like how this came about, you know?
And that's what's so much fun about going to any kind of market.
Absolutely.
Is to have those conversations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And really discovering, again, they're one-of-a-kind pieces that, you know, we were talking earlier, Liz, of this piece, of this photograph that you sent us for some promo material for it. And it's a piece that, I guess it was seven... It was one of the only pieces you've created, this comb that you were talking to me about.
It's a technique called plique-à-jour. It's an enameling technique that produces a piece of jewelry that's like a miniature stained glass window. So it can be think of a Tiffany window that you can wear. I use it to make cicada wings, dragonfly wings, flower petals, leaves. It's very labor intensive, and I'm the only person I know who does this technique, whether native or non-native. And
how did you learn it?
I went back east to a friend who named Bob Bover, and he knew how to do this technique, and he let me stay at his house for a week at a time until he taught me this technique, and he was very generous and very sweet. And but I saw this technique when I was about 17 years old. My dad showed me a book called The Master Jewelers, and he showed me the chapter of René Lalique's jewelry. And Lalique was known more for his glass work, but he was a jeweler first, and he did such incredible work. And my father was saying, look at this. You know, this is jewelry. And I just kept that in my mind ever since then. And when I was about 25, I ran into Bover, and we were talking, and we got on the subject of René Lalique, and he said, oh, I know how to do plique-à-jour. And I went, what? Yeah. Oh, my God, you're kidding. Because nobody knew how to do it. My dad didn't even know what it was called. He just said, see this? You can see behind it.
Yeah.
And it was such a magical technique, and very few contemporary jewelers do it.
Now, it looks like a stained glass window. What are the colored items that you can see through? What are they made of?
It's glass enamel.
Okay.
So think of cloisonné, and then it's backless. So I take a piece of silver, very thick, heavy silver, and I draw a pattern on it. And then I take my drill and drill out holes. And then from those holes, I insert a saw blade that's about the thickness of a couple of hairs, like a couple of your hairs on your head, and then saw out every single cell and try to leave a little thin vein of silver. And I've worked in gold as well. And then I clip that.
You have to have incredible manual dexterity to do this.
Oh, yes. My hands, just taking care of my hands.
When you think of the
like
word,
an hour every day.
Right, well, when you think of the word saw, and then you think of the... width of two hairs.
Yes.
It's a very, very fine saw you're talking about.
Oh, yes, and they break quite often, the saw blades. It's a jeweler's saw, so I like to use very thin blades because they leave fewer marks on the silver, so it's less cleanup. I'm not having to go in with my very small Swiss files or with a burr and clean up as much inside the walls. So it's a very delicate operation, but it's very demanding as well.
Do you find that Native people are wearing Native jewelry, or most of the people wearing it are sort of outsiders who come in with their wallets and buy this stuff and bring it back to St. Louis and Texas? And
most of my customers are people I meet at shows, but you know, that's... I think Native people love wearing Native jewelry. If you ever go to Gallup, for instance, and you go to the restaurants that are mostly the locals, mostly the Navajo people, everyone's wearing some kind of jewelry. And people actually, artists, will walk through with their work, whether it's like a little sand painting or jewelry, and will walk through these restaurants and sell to the customers. And so Native peoples are actually huge consumers of Native-made art.
And you have your roots in three different, in Maidu, Washoe, and Navajo. Do they all have different Indian traditions, and do you draw on those in terms of jewelry making?
Yes. Maidu and Washo are tribes from Northern California, and they were known for mostly making baskets out of willow and redbud. And sometimes I find myself, I'll be working on something very small that and sewing with wire, and I'll say to myself, it's these basket maker jeans coming out. And so, yeah, I've always wanted to learn basket making, and I've taken the time once in a while, but just processing the materials, there's a few weeks out of every year where you can even pick the willow shoots, the correct willow shoots to make a basket. And then there's another time of year where, and a different species of willow, where you have to go and get the bark. And it's that's a lifetime right there, just learning how to make baskets. And so there's only a handful of basket makers even alive anymore.
Very interesting. Gabe Gomez, let's talk for a moment about the cinema aspect of this winter Indian market, winter showcase. Native cinema is alive and well. Tell us about some of the offerings that are going to be happening this weekend.
Well, the particular titles were part of the Native Cinema Showcase this past summer. So we will see part of We Shall Remain, which was a PBS series that was shown earlier this year. So we'll be seeing that West Studios this particular one, Trail of Tears, I believe. It's the subtitle for this one. Christmas in the Clouds, of course, for all the sentimental holidayers out there, and Animation Celebration, which is a collection of shorts that's we're really excited about, again, for the kids, and that's going to be shown actually on Sunday. Altogether, there are six films, and to get some descriptions on them, you can go to our website,
which is
Swaya, SWAIA.org, and right on the homepage, it has our complete schedule of events, including the times and the dates for our demonstrations. And again, the films are going to be shown on Saturday, the 28th and the 29th, just afternoon, you know, type things, and it's extraordinary. So I think it's Native cinema is something that we hope to embrace even further in the program.
It's such a great moment, and we will be talking to some of the folks from the Santa Fe Film Festival next week. In fact, the entirety of next week on this show is devoted exclusively to the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Fabulous.
And one of the things that is so interesting for people who have been kind of excluded from cinema because of the cost of it is that the price of equipment to make a movie and the software to edit the movie has come way down. So people can get some little grant or scrape up some money and make a film.
Yeah. And then plus, I think the state is also willing to help to fund some of these endeavors, you know. And like you were saying, some of the software, not only is it accessible in price, but actually the usability of it. You know, it's an accessible tool. It's an accessible resource that, you know, even people like me can use.
You
know,
even people like you.
Even people like, could you believe that? No, seriously, I mean, you could still make very compelling art on a shoestring. And film is just one of those things where I think Native expression is just coming forth so strongly, at least from our point of view. And again, that's why we really want to be able to open the door to that even further.
Gabe Gomez is with SWAIA, the Southwest Association for Indian Arts. They can be found on the web at swaya.org. And Liz Wallace is a silversmith, and maybe you could give some of the websites or a website where people can find your work and images of your work.
Sure. My website is lizwallacerocks.com. That's LIZWALLACERocks.com. And I will be at the Santa Fe Convention Center this weekend. I will have one of the things I've made that is very unusual and outside the box for a Native artist is a silver belly dance set. I've been taking belly dance classes at Sultana Studios for about a year and a half, and I'll have a solid sterling silver bra and belt.
Will you be wearing it?
Oh, probably not.
Well, your sales might be affected by that, I'm just saying.
How?
Just checking, ladies and gentlemen.
That's awesome. And if I may say one thing that I haven't mentioned tonight, Robert Marable is going to be doing a special performance that he's put together for us. And it's actually really great. Our friends at Clear Light Books, they'll be selling books again for us. They sold for us this summer. Robert will be doing a performance.
And where is that? Also at the convention center?
At the convention center. What's going to happen is the doors are going to close around 5:30 today. And then they'll reopen, actually around, I'm sorry, closer to 5. And then reopen at 6. Show starts at 6:30 at the convention center. It's a performance. It's a selection from his holiday concert. And he's going to be doing some readings from the book itself. And then after the performance, which is approximately an hour or so, he'll be doing a book signing.
So he's got his own book out. He's well known as a musician, but not so much as a writer.
And a novelist and an actor, and he's all over the place. And so we're thrilled to have him. And also he'll be joining us as well and joining Liz and 170 or 80 some odd artists. And he'll be selling some of his flutes and his music and stuff like that. So he'll be there this weekend. So we're thrilled to have him there.
So a big weekend, and for those of you who do not want to join in the consumerist rush or the normal consumerist rush, there's a great deal to do just simply at the Santa Fe Convention Center. Thank you so much, Gabe Gomez and Liz Wallace, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome poet Anne Valley Fox. Her new book is called How Shadows Are Bundled, published by University of New Mexico Press, and she will be speaking this Sunday, November 29th, at Acequia Booksellers on 4th Street in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So your new book, How Shadows Are Bundled, I was thinking about the title, and you're starting with a paradox. Shadows being something you can't control, and bundling is an action that you do to something that you can't bundle.
That's exactly right. I hadn't thought of it, of course, myself. It's actually the title of one of the poems. And I think why it's the title of the book is that a lot of the poems are portraits of light and shadow.
Light and shadow in very much of a metaphorical...
Yes.
Yeah.
In individuals and in the collective psyche.
Why don't we start with reading one of the poems?
Love to. I'm going to start with one that imagines the arc of a woman's relationship to sexual power. And its original title was Promiscuity. It's called Catch and Release. Once out of the closet, an actual cranny, stale suits and dangling necktie nooses. It wasn't the custard embrace of women she wanted. No, it was men in their beautiful bodies, their minds like mineral quarries, wistful and reckless and crude. She knew how to cross a room and make them want her. The Rolling Stone, the family man pinned by Lilliputians, the spiritual master witching fishers. It wasn't salvation but clout she was after. Like generals plotting foreign wars, she'd bully the natives into submission and leave them. Once a stranger scooped her out of a green hole. She lay in his hands, swollen and gold as a carp. That time, she trembled before she leapt. If downstream another fisher could catch her, it was because she would let him. Sometimes she played at catch and release, but twice hooked, she'd flip back into the river, drifting dark down the dark caves of the current. Beached one day in the brown waters of Matamoros, she knelt and kissed the ground. Her children, like pea plants climbing into the blue, she lay down and the earth curved to hold her.
I'm glad you didn't call it promiscuity.
A little obvious, isn't it? Or too limiting, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a kind of a polarization that people make between a kind of puritanical goodness on the one hand and promiscuity on the other hand.
Right.
Whereas sexuality, right, in its beauty and fullness, can't be contained by either of those things.
That's beautiful. It's true. It's true. Promiscuity would be a judgment that someone from the outside would make. Although, in this particular psychic portrait, which I think it is, the woman being described has some of that judgment against herself. That's kind of important. in the poem, too.
I think also listening to that poem and reading some of the other poems, it strikes me that talking about gender and sexuality sometimes are better done through a poetic medium than through the direct bright light of psychology studies or something like that.
I know. There's this quote that I love by Osip Mandelstam. And he said, if a poem can be translated, in which case he means interpreted, if a poem can be translated, the sheets aren't rumpled, poetry hasn't spent the night. So, you know, we got to work these things over and toss and turn, and it's all complicated.
I guess by translated or interpreted, if you can say it better in another way, then the poem isn't doing its job.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. And it's tricky, too, because sometimes I'll read a poem, some of your poems included, and say, what is this about? What does this mean?
And of course, the answer is they're not about anything. They're like meteors or forces of energy or force fields. You'll notice that a poem is understood, is felt before it's ever understood, if it is ever understood.
I guess so. Although, I mean, you have a sonnet to your mailman. It's kind of about your mailman. It's kind of about you.
True. That's true. They are sometimes about something, but I just don't want to be held accountable for them, you know, being attached to an actual experience, because sometimes they are and sometimes they're not, and sometimes most often it's a mix.
In poetry, you use some of the tools of fiction. Some of the poems are maybe a little bit more like prose. Some of them are made up. They're fictional characters moving through these poems. Mm-hmm. What's the line between prose and poetry?
I think that my poems have characters in them, and they have stories in them. But it's I feel that my job is a gestalt to convey a feeling level, an intuitive sense of what something's about. My job is not to tell a story from the beginning to end, or to justify why a character makes a move or doesn't. Poems are shorter than novels, which is a wonderful aspect for somebody who's... when I first started writing, I liked writing poems because I could fit them into a little space. In fact, they go on and on. It takes me a long time to really finish a poem, but it's sort of a snap, sort of a gestalt, and that fits my personality better than the task, which I've never tried and I know I could never do, of telling a story from beginning to end in 350 pages and 5 years later, you know, drawing a sigh of relief.
Right. Although there is a genre of very, very short fiction, which are almost, I don't know what the difference is really between that kind of sudden fiction, half a page story on the one hand, and one of your prose poems on the other.
Prose poems, they kind of bridge the gap between poetry and prose. And I adore prose poems. I like to write them, and I really like to read a good one. Because and it's hard to say what, for your listeners, I mean, a prose poem is where it looks like a paragraph rather than broken lines of various lengths, so that you have the right margin is justified rather than ragged.
To what extent do you work with traditional forms, sonnet, haiku? There are some of these, rhyme, not so much.
I've played with them all, but I don't tend to just naturally go there. So I'm just listening for the music inside myself. And as soon as I can find the beginning of a melody, I'm off and running. And then the poem tells you what its shape wants to be.
Right.
Uh-huh. Once you get it rolling.
We're talking to poet Anne Valley Fox. Her new book is called How Shadows Are Bundled. Would you like to read another poem?
I'd love to. So this book has two parts. One is portraits of individuals, imaginary or real or something in between. And the second part is about the collective unconscious. And I'd like to read a couple more maybe from the individual. So This is a portrait of, it attempts to describe a man who wants out and makes a sudden break for it. And I'm trying to describe why and how he does this. The man in the mirror. I wake in a room on the fourth floor, iron balcony, April light, and stand in the bathroom looking into the mirror. My body has blown apart in the night like a pile of sand. Livid with loathing, I pack my bag, quit the hotel, and hail a cab for the airport. At home, I regretfully tell my wife, I no longer love you, I'm leaving. How can it be that the more she weeps, the more my flesh firms in the morning mirror?
That's pretty heavy.
It is. And there's a big story there, and it's whittled down to about 10 lines.
Now, is that a story that on some level was inspired by something that you saw or experienced in some way?
That one was. I you know, saw a man leave his wife summarily after a long relationship just very suddenly, and it was a shock, of course, to her and to all their friends. And I have another poem in the book, in fact, called Notes to a Man Who's Thinking of Leaving His Wife, and I'm trying to rationalize with him, and I can't find a single real reason to say don't go other than it hurts, you know. But anyway, I was looking at this particular person and thinking, trying to imagine what would be going on in a person that he would suddenly need to change his life in that way. So I imagined this scenario of the mirror in the hotel.
Very interesting. There's a film that's screening next week in the Santa Fe Film Festival called Character, and it's about how actors play different characters. And one of the actors in the film, it's a documentary, said most actors are liberal rather than conservative. And the reason for that is when you're an actor, you have to walk in other people's shoes. And when you do that, you're no longer able to judge them so harshly.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that you would have the same experience in, for example, in that poem, trying to put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
Very much. It's good for me. It's good. I think it's good for the being to have to stretch and wiggle around like that. And compassion helps, but you know, the imagination can take you a long way too. It's like I love that Walt Whitman line of "Be plural like the universe," and that's what I hope to do in this particular collection.
If you think about it, plural and universe has uni in it. It's kind of an oxymoron.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, Whitman contradicted himself all the time.
I know. Well, we use that word. It's the only word we've got. It should be multiverse or something.
Yes, it should be. We'll have to work on that.
Dictionary writers out there. The book is divided, the book of poetry is divided into various sections. Psyche, things that want to be counted, new math, and you'll have to pronounce the last one for us.
Cheekshilub.
What is that last word?
It's the name of a meteor that struck the Earth around the Yucatan Peninsula. I mean, scientists have put this together, and it really decimated the dinosaurs about 60 million years ago.
That's the meteor that killed the dinosaurs?
Well, they think so. It may have. Hard to say, yeah. You know, but probably.
Why did you use that image for this section of poems?
It's, again, the name of a title of a poem that's has many parts to it, including starting with the impact of the meteor on the Earth and then moving to people jumping off the World Trade Towers, to the human relationship with the Earth in many different contexts. And so the meteor, the scientists call that a meteor of that magnitude and a civilization ender. So it felt like it was big. It's important. And I'm not trying to say that the civilization is about to come to an end. I'm not an apocalyptic writer or thinker. But I'm just wanting the Earth to loom large in our universe and in our worldview.
Would you like to read another poem?
Sure. So I'll progress to the part of the book that's more about the collective unconscious. This one is called Barrel of Night. The way wild salmon power up laddered falls, drop their pearls in gravel and slide downward, or parrots swivel squawking heads on top of their bright bodies. Other species do not distress themselves, with certain exceptions, for instance, a modern dancer spiraling out of contraction. Human beings are doomed to review the conditions, good, evil, boredom, dread, freedom, commitment. Who am I? Where am I going? Each decision a fist of dirt gathering into a landslide. Who doesn't lie awake in the steel barrel of night, struggling to get things right? The vet on the radio, recently back from Iraq, terrified in his other mind, he'll lunge at the baby, cut off her fingers, whatever else he will do. His mind a pit mine, scraped bald, fogged in paranoia. He comes around wrapped in bars or a straitjacket, more than ever afraid of himself. Certain trails are treacherous to go back over. Who can foresee quicksand traps in a clear stream? A false step you take at 20 that lasts as many years. The one where a child slips underwater. We cling to the lines, the spinning compass, teased by sirens calling our secret names.
Anne Valley Fox. The book is called, the book of poetry is called How Shadows Are Bundled. I want to ask you a question, and I'll preface it by saying that I'm not suggesting, although many people do this and it's fine or whatever, that poetry or writing is in itself a therapeutic process. But what does the writing of poetry do for you, do for the poet?
There's a character in an E.M. Forester novel that says, well, I write so that I know what I think. And that's always been the case with me. Not only what I think, but who I am, what I feel, how to make sense of things. You start out writing a poem or anything, really, other than a thesis. You start out with something, and you follow it along, and you find where it goes. And the poem starts to make sense of things for you. And to me, that's tremendously important. I can't bear the... You know, it's difficult to bear life without any synthesis or without any meaning. That thing that John Keats talked about, the negative capability to exist in the person who can exist in mystery and doubt and uncertainty without the irrational, the irritable reaching after fact and reason. It's difficult, I think, for modern people to live in a world with so many contradictions and so much terror and violence and destruction and pain and suffering. And this is my means for sort of touching it all and kind of turning it over and making it my own experience without holding on to it. The poem then is an expression, and it's something that goes out beyond you, so it's not stuck within oneself.
There is a process of completing a poem that I'm sure you know very well, and it's great ups and downs, and I imagine some of them are completed quickly and some of them you labor over for a really long time. You just talked about this letting go of the poem. How do you know when it's done? I would imagine that it's being done is that which allows you to let go of not only the poem, but the mass of feeling that the poem is about.
Yeah. I know if I can read it out loud to you, and there's not a word or a line break or a metaphor or any piece of it that says, ouch, oh no, that's not right. The poem has to release me. It has to say, okay, I'm ready to settle. Even if there are places in it that are bumpy or not perfect, that's not the same as being finished. Anyway, the poem tells me when it's finished. And it's mostly when it stops giving me trouble.
Ah. You know. What is it like when it is giving you trouble? What is that process or interaction in like?
It's trying to find a way to say something The words, maybe sometimes it's just one word. It could be an idea. The one that I mentioned, the notes to a man who was thinking of losing his wife, leaving his wife, both. That poem took me about 2 years because I had a conclusion. I had something I wanted to say. I had one reason why this was not such a good idea. And I thought it was a beautiful reason, and I worked really hard to come up with it. And I stuck it on the bottom of at the end of the poem, and a couple of friends critiqued the poem for me and said, it sounds moralistic, it sounds judgmental, it's not working. And I was so disappointed because I really liked that ending. But finally I realized that ending was wrong, and I couldn't have it. I wasn't going to be allowed to have that ending. So once I threw it out, I found another ending which felt better and worked better, and the whole poem sort of slinked into itself.
Did you give the poem to the man?
I did.
And?
And he's out of town. We haven't actually talked about it, but I know it's all right. Yeah.
Anne Valley Fox is the author of the new book, How Shadows Are Bundled, with a foreword by the poet V.B. Price. It's published by the University of New Mexico Press. And once again, she will be this weekend, Sunday, November 29th, at the Acequia Booksellers on 4th Street in Albuquerque. It's wonderful having you with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Maybe we have time for one more quick poem.
I'm going to read to you Mad Elephants. I wrote it immediately after 9/11 when I remember feeling a sense of doom about how the U.S. was going to respond to the attacks on our land, which then took up that rather sinister term from another era, homeland.
Right.
And your listeners may remember how soon after that President George Bush went into a huddle with some generals and military advisors to see how we were going to retaliate. And this poem reflects, you know, my personal concern about what kind of strategy they were going to come up with. And of course now there are deliberations going on the same topic about war in Afghanistan, and although they seem to be more thoughtful and substantive than they were in 2001, the content of the poem is still chillingly appropriate. Mad Elephants, that has an epigraph from a little book by Lama Yeshe called Make Your Mind an Ocean. He said, "It is so worthwhile that you devote your precious human life to controlling your mad elephant mind." Mad Elephants. Under guard at Camp David, metal-chested generals, purple hearts and scrubbed hands are locked in private council with the president. Big brass and enfant terrible, their own prodigal son. Out the window, rain strafes the open faces of 8 coral roses. I've muffled the phone and gagged the Sunday paper. Half the world will fall to its knees as we bomb the land of Afghanistan with mad elephants.
Anne Valley Fox, thanks again.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Jazz a la Carta.